it has the advantage of having a sharp blade as well as a point, so you can use it to cut as well as thrust. But in terms of handiness, when you come and look at this bayonet afterwards, ladies and gentlemen, you'll realise just how unsuitable for hand-to-hand fighting this bayonet is. Yet, it was used by sergeants, and in the Sudan campaign, the Camel Corps will all be issued with it. A mystery to me why. But that is the Yagatan. So that is the bayonets in use. And now we go over to the Martini Henry rifle. Now this rifle is the culmination of a competition amongst leading firearms manufacturers in the late 1860s. This is the result of all the tenders put in by the top firearms designers and manufacturers at the time. It's sighted first to 1100 yards, so it has a long range. It's the first rifle that has a necked down bullet. In other words, a bullet shaped like a milk bottle. So it has a broad base and a narrow neck, so that the force is built up in a large chamber and forced through a smaller one to build up velocity in the barrel. So the result of that is it kicks quite hard, much harder than the previous weapon, which was a derivative of the 1853 Enfield with a breech-loading mechanism known as the Schneider. It kicked much harder than the Schneider, and therefore it acquired a bit of a reputation for brutality. It's a 4.5 calibre, as I say, black powder charge, and it's quite accurate. 400 yards, you can hit a man-sized target at 400 yards with this rifle at Bisley tomorrow. Bisley's a stone's throw from here, and these rifles are still very popular there, being shot by sporting shooters there. In terms of how to fire it, normally we do these tactical considerations, but we'll stay in for as long as we can and just go out to actually fire it in a minute. But the tactical doctrine in the manual suggests that we don't fire this too rapidly, because when we fire a volley is often the way these weapons are fired, you let the smoke clear between shots before you fire into it again. The other major consideration with it is the bullet weighs about four times that of a .303 bullet. So if any of you are marksmen with a .303, the bullet is four times the weight. And it's driven by black powder, so it has a very arcing trajectory, meaning it fires like a mortar. It goes up and then it comes down, rather than flying straight through like a modern high-velocity rifle. So it's very important that the rifleman checks the range on his sights before he lets fly. Because if the target is at 500 yards and your sights are set for 1,000 or 100, you will either plough the earth or overfly the target and waste your fire. The white Zulu John Dunn observes at Jinjin I Love You, I think it was the 3rd 60th, apparently blazing away without so much as a glance at their sights and their ranging. And he accused them of wasting their fire. Maybe they were young soldiers, maybe he got it wrong. But a proper marksman with a Martini has to watch the sights. That man calling the shots has to call the distance accurately. Calling the shots is the officer or the NCO who's commanding the firing. Right, firing. I think now is the time to go and see a bit of firing. We're going to pop out the back doors fairly briefly, and we're going to do some Martini firing in the snow. So we're going to have I think we'll pop our jackets on, and then we'll meet outside the back door in a couple of minutes. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as I said, firing was normally conducted in volleys, and the man calling the shots would estimate the distance to the target, in which case we'll say that there's a Zulu force skirmishing forward a range, say, 600 yards. Now, with a Martini's recoil, ladies and gentlemen, the lads would be progressing back along the car park, I should think. Right, so we have a Zulu force skirmishing forward 600 yards over there. So the man calling the shots will give the order. One volley at 600 yards. Ready? On the command ready, the lads take that under that firing drill, that half-pace turn to the right, which brings their right shoulder back to excuse me, set the butt. They load, they look up, and they check for their target. When the man calling the shot sees them all look up, he knows they're ready. Now, the order they get then is not to fire. They get present, and after two beats of slow time, they then deliver their fire. So let's watch this volley. Present! And they all fire together after two beats of slow time. Right, let's just have some gratuitous firing now, chaps. We're going to do three quick volleys, and then we're going to do five rounds independent. Independent firing is after the target is perhaps too close for volleys to remain effective, and if it looks like they're going to get to close quarters, we need to thin them out quick and fast and let the men pick their moment when they fire for maximum perfect aim and effect. So, three volleys at 600 yards. Ready? Present! Ready? Present! Weaver, you're on a charge. Ready? You'll be on two charges if you don't get the next one in. Present! Five rounds, independent firing. Commence! Loading from the expense pouch, ladies and gentlemen. Each shot in the soldier's own time, taking careful aim for each shot. Private Weaver there is the darling of the British government. He's saving ammunition. All done, lads. Unload! Show clear to Corporal Church. Ladies and gentlemen, let's go back inside. Thank you very much. So, let's carry on then where we left off. Martini Henry. There are some shortcomings, and you saw some of those shortcomings just now. Jam they can and jam they do. The early ammunition type for the Martini Henry consists of a turned steel base with a rolled brass body on the cartridge. Under heavy firing, when the breeches get hot, it's not unknown for the solder to melt that holds them together and the soldier to eject the base plug, leaving the brass case stuck in the barrel. The only way to get that out is to use your clearing rod thrown down from the front to try and dislodge it, or to desperately dig it out with a knife. Not a pleasant experience with Zulu warriors bearing down upon you. That's its worst shortcoming. It doesn't like sand. If you get sand in the mechanism, it's doing nothing until you can open it up, get it out, oil it. So most soldiers in a desert environment will keep it muzzled, will keep it cloth covered and muzzle plugged at all times. The Martini does come with actually a brass muzzle plug for that very purpose. So that's enough about the British infantry. That's the typical defenders of Rorke's Drift, who initially on that day, 22nd of January 1879, with their comrades being massacred 10 miles away, they're in blissful ignorance. The post commander, Major Spaulding, had said that morning when he left to ride up to help Macar on an errand, "Chard, you'll be in charge, but nothing's going to happen anyway." Prophetic words that will see Spaulding consigned to being forgotten, and Chard remembered. Well, we all know him, don't we, ladies and gentlemen? And most other people do, not just because of Stanley Baker either. So, life goes on at the post. Sick men in the hospital, others doing their duty. Rorke's Drift was a staging area on one of the invasion routes for Zululand. It is well stocked with mealies, which is the food provided to native levies and to some beasts of burden. It's in large, very large, heavy Hessian sacks. Quite heavy, quite cumbersome to move. It's also richly festooned with biscuit boxes, army biscuit, twice baked to keep it fresh but hard as rock, and it's a substitute for bread if fresh bread can't be provided. That is in large boxes, about the size of a tea chest, but heavier because they're made of stouter wood and they're packed with biscuit. Ammunition is plentiful there because the battalion's, a significant part of the battalion's reserve ammunition is there. So they're actually fairly well provided for to conduct the defence that they actually begin to mount. The need for that defence becomes obvious when riders start to appear on lathered horses with ashen faces from Isandhlwana, reporting the disaster that has befallen their comrades there. Now, most of us in this room would probably, if we'd been there, have greeted that with disbelief. But the more of those fugitives in the battle that started to arrive, it became obvious to them that a disaster had befallen the column and that a significant Zulu force was on the way to attack them. It was Commissary Dalton, a veteran infantry soldier now serving in the Commissary Department. I'll say little about him because he's the subject of Andy Robertshaw's talk later. His idea is to fortify the post with the bags and the boxes of the present and prepare it for defence. Now, at the point when that suggestion is made, there are at least 300 to 400 members of the Natal Native contingent present and a smaller number of British soldiers. So the defences are designed around about 425 men being present. So quite a considerable, the breastwork as we know it is constructed, consisting of the mealy bags and the biscuit boxes, in a fairly wide perimeter. The problem was that when the Zulus were known to be approaching fairly closely, the members of the Natal Native contingent, who are native levies serving in the British Army for pay, they decide that discretion is the better part of valour with a massive Zulu host coming down on them, and they leg it up over the barricades and away. One of their white NCOs goes with them and is shot in the head for his trouble by one of the chaps left on the mealy bags. But that leaves a massive problem. We've built defences for 400 men and we've only got 125 to man them. So initially, where we might have started the defence with this sort of spacing, we've now got one man in the space for four. So the lads must have felt pretty exposed along the wide expanses of those mealy bags. And they must have felt really exposed when the Zulus first hove into view and we start to open fire upon them. They come late in the afternoon and they lap round the post and they strike what appears to them to be the weakest part of the defences, which is that in front of the hospital building. Two buildings there, you all know that. They strike the mealy bags at the front of the hospital building, which are incomplete, and a second line has been put up inside them. They're low and they're inadequate. And that is the place where they hit first. And they're able to come right up to the defences. Fortunately, on that side of the defences, there's a bit of an escarpment, a small escarpment, stone ridge that comes up. So it actually increases the height of the defences, which have been constructed to about just above stomach height, perhaps, about that. And our men are opening fire on them up with the Martinis, knocking them down in large numbers. And it's then that the Zulu use of firearms starts to tell upon us, because behind the post is the Oscarberg terraces. It's a hill and it has a series of caves at a low height, at a fairly low level. But low level though it be, it's only about 300 yards behind the post, and Zulu marksmen steal up into those caves and holes and that cover, and they start opening fire with the Enfields and the smoothbores and whatever else they have, and their fire is falling on the backs of the men who are exposed along the mealy bags to the front of the hospital. So they are fighting men to their front, and pot legs and bullets are whizzing past them from behind. Now, as I said before, a Zulu marksman will be fortunate to hit his individual target at 300 yards, but with a red coat spaced along the mealy bags like that, some men are going to cop one, and men start to fall, struck in their backs of their heads, from fire from the Oscarberg. So marksmen in the British force are set to work to open fire back and try and keep their heads down. But it's difficult to engage a target that's hidden with a martini. They're aiming at the smoke, and so fire begins to come in both ways. Chard then has the necessary and brilliant notion that a biscuit bag box line be very quickly thrown up to separate the yards into two. So he throws that line across the left-hand side of the storehouse, effectively, so that when everyone withdraws into it, those exposed on the front face will be covered by the back wall of the storehouse. So it was quite a stroke of genius, really. And at the point when the biscuit box wall was almost complete, everyone was withdrawn from the left half of the defence, and they literally ran in and took up position in the defences in front of the storehouse, and also manning the cattle kraal on their right. The men in the cattle kraal were still slightly exposed from the fire of the Oscarburg, but those in front of the hospital, the storehouse, were shielded by its walls. So immediately that was a success there, in that our men were in cover now. What it did do, though, was to leave the hospital on the left-hand side of the defences exposed and surrounded on three sides by a howling mass of Zulu warriors, isolated and without passage to the storehouse end. And it's here that Ian is going to take over from myself. I'm going to hand over the... Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.